It's a joy to be here. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or work in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I actually live in Massachusetts, but work in Cambridge for the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. How many of you are familiar with the work of the Service Committee? All right, a few of you. Good. I'm going to give you a little introduction to the Service Committee. We were started a little more than 75 years ago by events of the day. World War II was heating up, and there was a group of Unitarian Universal or Unitarians at the time who were deeply concerned about what was happening in Europe. And Waitzel and Martha Sharp were asked to go to Europe to try to help rescue folks and to move them to safety, because the Nazi regime was beginning to target folks. So they went to Europe and they helped a bunch of people get out and move farther west to England and to France. And then they had to go back because Germany was winning the war. And so a lot of those folks that had been helped to leave the more dangerous parts of Germany now had to be removed again from places in England and France where they had been moved to. So our history as the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is grounded in helping people to find their way and to support those who are most oppressed and who most face the hatred and harm that we do to one another. So I'm grateful to be working there. Much has changed over the years since we've been doing what we do. And when I started at the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee about a little over 2 years ago, I wasn't entirely sure what I was signing up for. I've been a minister for about 20 years, so I've been doing all kinds of fundraising for UUSC for a long time. We have this thing called Guest at Your Table. Are you familiar with this program? So it's a big fundraiser that we do every year with Stories of Hope, and we kind of encourage people to donate to the programs that UUSC does. So I used to do this skit, right, and to try to get people to encourage people to donate. And what I would do is set up a big spaghetti dinner, and I'd have a big glass of milk, and I'd take a Tyvek envelope, and I'd pour the spaghetti dinner into the envelope, and then pour the glass of milk in on top of it, and I'd be like, this is not the most practical way to support the efforts of UUSC. And it always got a couple of laughs, and people always sort of gasped when the milk went in, and fortunately it never leaked. But the truth is that a check is always better than trying to send food, and especially a check of $125, because that gets matched by Veatch. So if you're thinking about donating, we encourage that. But my view of what UUSC had to offer was pretty narrow, because that was my experience and my exposure. What I didn't realize is just how complex the work of UUSC is. One thing that we do is we provide small grants to cutting-edge organizations. These are groups that nobody else would fund because they don't have their 501c3 yet, or they're not quite organized enough to really kind of get off the ground. Groups like a group in South Africa that's working to counter the export of evangelical homophobia from the United States. We provided support to a group called Tewa after the earthquake in Nepal in 2010, and those funds supported rural women and children rebuilding and establishing networks of care and support. Those relationships have led to economic and political collaborations that have helped advance the rights of women and children in rural Nepal. We helped to build eco-villages in Haiti, and we've supported Syrian refugees fleeing war and violence. At UUSC, we center our work on support for grassroots indigenous communities and for those most impacted communities. We're guided by our UU principles and by the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and we strive to advance human rights, dismantle systems of oppression, and uplift and affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people. We center the voices and the experiences of those most affected and strengthen the grassroots groups and movement organizing themselves to advance these goals. And we do this through justice education and leadership development. We do organizing for advocacy and action, and we do grant making and partner support. And we make grants to both domestic and to international organizations seeking to expand human rights and social justice. And we do more than that. In the past 2 years, I've learned a lot about the kinds of things that we do here. And just yesterday, I was in San Diego offering a regional justice training on Love Resists, which is our joint campaign with the Unitarian Universalist Association. So for those of you here in California, if you followed UUSC's work around the human right to water in the previous decade, you may be familiar with the work that we've done. California remains the only state in the nation with a human right to water. Congratulations. You've done well. So those of you that are familiar with Guest at Your Table know that we raise thousands of dollars each year, and we provide about $1 million worth of grants out to these small community organizations. And each contribution that we receive makes a difference. We currently have three major areas of focus with an understanding that these issues are interlinked and interdependent. We're working on Central American migration, climate force displacement, and the criminalization of migrants and asylum seekers through our Love Resists work. Our work with Central American migration is currently focused on supporting those asylum seekers who come to the border and who are given a hard time and often sent immediately into detention. We're trying to stop the expansion of detention and to suspend U.S. military support to Honduras. Now, these efforts, combined with a joint efforts through the UUA on our Love Resists campaign, make up a good portion of our domestic portfolio. And expanded sanctuary is a big part of that. I'm sure many of you are aware that San Diego, your sister congregation in San Diego, just voted to become a sanctuary congregation. So we congratulate them and we appreciate that hard discernment process. Perhaps a conversation here to become a supporting congregation, because it's not easy to keep someone in sanctuary and it requires a tremendous amount of volunteers. When someone is in sanctuary, they literally cannot leave the building. And so, you know, food purchases, taking kids to school, all those things need to happen through volunteers. So we encourage you to consider the conversation of discernment to be a supporting congregation. UUSC's other focus is on climate force displacement. And with grants to two indigenous communities, one in Alaska and one in the South Pacific, we're seeking to empower these communities to have a say in what happens to them as they face rising sea levels that threaten their homes, their communities, and their way of life. Many around the globe will be forced to move, and few with the power to help are thinking and planning about these imminent needs. We know without question that climate change is happening, that it's real, and that it has been accelerating. Areas along the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico have faced multiple hundred-year storms within months of each other. And here in California, you've faced fires and mudslides coming at a record pace. Mother Nature declaring her preeminence in all of this. New Orleans has still not fully recovered, and probably never will, as communities of color and poor communities remain isolated and ignored. And Puerto Rico, 6 months after Hurricane Maria, still has hundreds without reliable power. Naomi Klein speaks of disaster capitalism. Do y'all know what this is? This is when the vultures come in after a disaster and try to privatize everything. It happened after Katrina. The reason that we have as many charter schools that we do now is because of Katrina. That big push happened after that. It's an attempt to take advantage of the chaos, to privatize everything in the aftermath of the disaster, and to pull those resources away from the common good. So far, Puerto Rico has been able to hold their ground and has insisted on maintaining the power grid as a public utility, but the pressure is great, and they will continue to struggle. For years, we've tried to contain and control nature, even as we've fueled the heating of the earth. I think about how we've stripped away the beauty, how we've reduced the natural world to resources. We've removed the sacred. We no longer participate in singing the land. I have seen these changes in my own short lifetime, and it gives me pause for the future. I lament for my son, who will be soon 21. I have to ask, What have we done in the name of greed and human advancement? We are like motherless children, friendless, almost gone, a long, long way from home. And still I have hope. I've heard stories of the indigenous leaders in Alaska and the Pacific Islands. I've seen pictures and videos of the king tides as they crash high on the beaches of Kiribati, taking not just the sand and belongings, but taking lives as well. One of the elders of Kiribati, an island in the South Pacific, tells this story. He says, "I grew up here on the islands and lived my whole life here. Our way of life is simple. The place we live is paradise. We, in this present generation, have inherited these small islands, and we are proud to be the owners of the beautiful homes that our ancestors secured for us. But our lives have been radically changed in my lifetime. I used to fish for our food and for our income, but the ocean has changed in many ways. The water has grown warmer as the currents shift and change with the melting ice caps and rising water levels. The coral reefs are bleaching out. The fish are dying off. We can no longer count on fishing to sustain us in the same way. And that's not even the worst of it. My grandparents have had to move twice in the last 10 years as rising sea levels have encroached upon their village. And me? I'm wide awake in Kiribati because the ocean is roaring outside my window. Every 30 seconds or so, there's a low, thundering sound, like someone dragging a large table across an empty school hall. Annoyed at not being able to sleep, I get up to identify the sound to see for myself. The pounding growl is from the large waves hitting the seawall outside our house. It's unexplainably murderous. We build seawalls to hold the tides back, but the king tides are growing stronger and higher than we or our ancestors have ever seen before. I watch as the tide comes in, battering the small seawall, pounding and tearing at my futile attempts to protect my home, my land. I think of my friends, Manetea Rotake and Itaka Tiriu, both of whom lost their wives in the king tides. Itake lost his home and his land and had to move inland to live with relatives, but who knows how long he can even live there. The scientists tell us that the tides eventually will impact the groundwater, making it impossible to obtain potable water and destroying our agriculture. And Manatita, he was an elder on the island. A king tide hit his property a few years ago and completely destroyed his kitchen and his sleeping hut. But it also washed away all of the topsoil on his land, leaving behind only a sandy beach. Soon the trees started dying one after another. He loved the sea because it provided his family with food. But what threatens his land is that same sea. He would not leave the island. He lived on the same plot of land from the day he was born, just after World War II. His wife died the same year that the bad king tides came and was buried on their land. He refused to leave and stayed there until he died in 2016. He's now buried in the land he loves with his wife. A seawall protecting both of them now stands at the edge of the property. Our relation to the ocean is changing. Fish are harder to find. Tides are higher and more dangerous. The reef is dying. Flooding causes death and destruction with more regularity. We are not the cause of climate change, but we are being most impacted by it. The tide comes in again, and in an hour the ocean will shrink back, suggesting its work here is done. It will move on to another victim. But it will be back. The next big tide will arrive just a little bit scarier, a little bit louder, a little bit more ferocious, and a little bit angrier. And this is living with climate change. It's here, and it's ferocious. These people, the ones who will be forced to move, they are among the ones who have contributed the least to the warming of the planet. These are the people living closest to the earth, fishing and farming, mending nets, building boats, celebrating communities in story and song. Like so many living near the coast, as the water rises, they seek to mitigate the damage with seawalls and stopgaps, adapting as best they can with the little in the way of resources and support. Here in California, the constant drought has led to more and more fires, damaging more acres as the wind blows the hot, dry air, pushing the fires further, claiming more land and more lives. We adapt as best we can, clearing the brush away from our houses, following the guidelines we've all been taught, that we've been told will protect us. Adapting, mitigating, offering stopgap measures to make us feel that we can somehow control what's happening. And still there's hope. Investment bankers are cutting ties with fossil fuel producers, and individuals who understand the real costs are withdrawing their support. Protests over pipelines are happening all over the country as people begin to realize what is truly at stake. Progressive and not-so-progressive corporations are seeing the writing on the wall, and the smart ones are planning for alternative energy sources in the future. And people, real lives, are being impacted in ways large and small. And not just the communities of color and indigenous populations. Some of you have wealth tied to your property. And for some, that wealth may be more precarious as you begin to see property values shifting because of the climate change that's happening. The fear is real. And none of us can escape. Far too many, 94% of the population, will see significant impacts of climate change in the coming years. And 6% will fare better than others, insulated, at least temporarily, from the most egregious impacts of climate change by wealth and power. But even the wealthy are not entirely exempt. Montecito, your neighbors to the north, had a horrible winter. Mother Nature doesn't discriminate. The Reverend Michael Schuller, the minister of the First Unitarian Society of Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, writes, 30 years ago, James Hansen of the Goddard Institute for Space Science testified before Congress about the rapid rise of greenhouse gases in the Earth atmosphere and what this might bode for our future. 4 years later, representatives from 172 countries gathered in Rio de Janeiro for the first Earth Summit and adapted the Convention on Climate Change. Since then, additional compacts have been sealed at Kyoto, Copenhagen, and most recently Paris in 2015. And yet, not only has the challenge not been met, conditions have actually deteriorated. Between 2000 and 2010, 3,322 environmental disasters, droughts, wildfires, extreme temperature events, floods, and storms were reported worldwide. This represents a five-fold increase over the decade of the 1970s. More climate events are inevitable, and how we face them is what matters. We have structures of support in place, like FEMA, but as we've seen, those resources can be fickle, as hundreds and perhaps thousands remain without power in Puerto Rico. And 13 years later, parts of the Lower Ninth Ward remain devastated. While Mother Nature may not discriminate, human beings certainly do. As part of our mandate to advance human rights, dismantle systems of oppression, and uplift and affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people, UUSC is working to shift that narrative. This fall, we are working with organizations in Alaska and the Pacific Islands to bring together indigenous leadership from all around the globe, those most at risk for and already facing climate force displacement, a designation not yet recognized as a valid refugee status. These leaders are gathering to discuss the challenges of adaptation and mitigation. They are gathering to discuss how they might be heard in their right to choose how, when, and where they will move. This is the first convening of its kind and will give voice to the least, to those who least contribute to climate change but are the most impacted by it. This gathering seeks to honor the wisdom and dignity of those communities and to support their right to self-determination. There are many groups doing climate justice work, and I know many of you are deep in that work. What we know is we know what we need to do. Like, we actually have the answers. We already know this. It's not like we don't know what we need to do. The problem is that we need the will to do it. Disruption, withdrawal of financial support, empowering indigenous communities, establishing alternative energy resources, reducing, reusing, recycling. These are all steps that matter if we're truly to have hope for the future, if our children and our grandchildren are to have a fighting chance. Every contribution matters, not just to UUSC, but to the future of the planet. We each and all must contribute what we can. Perhaps someday soon we will find our way to honoring the sacred beneath our feet, singing the beauty of the land once again. Recognizing, as Wendell Berry says, the abundance of this place, the songs of its people and its birds will be health and wisdom and indwelling light. This is no paradisal dream. Its hardship is its possibility. Blessed be. Amen.